He might just be the hardest working man in golf media, and John McGinnis has plenty to say in this new episode of Musings on Golf. Hello, once again, Kelly Elbin here. You are absolutely going to love hearing from John McGinnis in just a few minutes. He and Brian Katrick have formed quite a twosome in their most enjoyable Katrick and McGinnis on Tap program that's aired for more than a decade now on Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio. You know, this show was founded on great storytelling, and that's right up Mr. McGinnis's alley. We'll also talk, and mostly we're going to talk after the interview with John about, you know, with the saga, the woes of Tommy Fleetwood, clearly the thrills for his fellow countryman, Justin Rose, prevailing over J.J. Spahn in a three-hole playoff at the FedEx St. Jude Championship in Memphis. And there's a lot of Ryder Cup configurations, particularly for the U.S. team, following the BMW Championship this week outside of Baltimore. Both Patrick Cantlay and Ricky Fowler earlier today at press conferences came out and flat out said, look, Keegan Bradley's done enough. He deserves to be on that team. You're going to hear John echo that. Keegan's 39 years old. He would be, and I think it will happen, he would be the first playing captain on either side since Arnold Palmer in 1963 at East Lake outside of Atlanta, which is ironically where the Tour Championship will be played next week. Okay, John McGinnis, wow. I mean, how certain events can shape one's life. And in John's case, how literally a single question, one single question can set up a career and something that John, and he's very, very honest about it, never, ever had envisioned. He talks at length early on about that event. It was an injury that gave him an opportunity to ask that question. And that crazy question he asked of the world's best player at the time, the response, the lengthy response from the world's best player at the time, how that all propelled John to, you know, becoming such a busy guy in golf media. John McGinnis was a solid player. He won three times on what is now the Korn Ferry Tour, but he only went so far on the PGA Tour. And he even jokes about the fact that had he got his insurance license, and had he become an insurance salesman, he would have made a heck of a lot more money. And he's probably right based on all of the guys he knew and played against on the PGA Tour, if he had followed the insurance road. But truth be told, John, to me, is a real gift to those of us who care about the game. And the reason is he's so passionate about it, and he's so knowledgeable, played it at a high level, is out there all the time, knows the players, and he's a master storyteller. Look, those stories you're going to hear about Tiger, you're going to hear a really funny little funny anecdote about Nick Faldo. He'll talk about Justin Rose and Tommy Fleetwood. And he even mentions one of the greatest authors of all time. So you're in for a real treat hearing from John McGinnis, and you will enjoy that interview immensely right after these words from our great partners, William & Harry and Titleist. William & Harry has entered a bold new era led by their new Lionhead logo, symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose. Outplay the field and dominate your opponent. While wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style, William & Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFF M-O-G for 15% off. William & Harry, walk with the lion.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with the wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest score.
Well, Well, for more than a decade, our special guest today has been one half of a most entertaining and informative duo on SiriusXM PGA Tour Radio. He also has walked countless miles reporting on the game at the highest levels for a variety of outlets. And, of course, he's on site this week as the FedEx Cup playoffs head to Caves Valley Golf Club outside of Baltimore for the BMW Championship. Three times he was victorious on what is now the Korn Ferry Tour. And in his second event ever as a reporter, he produced one of the greatest questions ever asked of Tiger Woods. John McGuinness, great to see you. Welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So please revisit the venue, the question to Tiger, and his response.
So here's the thing. This was 2004. And right. I was in a sling. I had literally just had elbow surgery 2 weeks before or 3 weeks before. And I was aware of the fact that my career was probably going to be over soon. I could see the writing on the wall. My body was falling apart and kids were getting younger and stronger.
Yeah.
I was studying to get the insurance license that I knew I'd need to support my family after that. My agent called, asked me if I wanted to do 2 weeks of broadcasting. For USA Network, remember, it was USA Network back then that had Thursday, Friday coverage.
Yep.
I said, no, I don't have any interest in that. I don't want to be one of those guys. And he said, well, hang on a second. Before he said, no, the first week is the Senior Players Championship in Dearborn, Michigan. I can fly you up on Wednesday afternoon. You're going to work 4 to 6 on Thursday, 4 to 6 on Friday. I can fly you out Friday night. You get 2 nights in the Ritz-Carlton, and they'll pay you $5,000. And I said, you know what? I could handle that. So the next week is the Buick Open. I walk with Tiger 2 hours, 4 to 6 on Friday afternoon. Now, this is the end of my broadcast career. It's lasted 2 full weeks. Right. And I have, 18-time Emmy Award winner Lance Barrow in my headset as I'm interviewing Tiger, who has been picking on me for having a sling as I'm following him for the last 7 holes. And Lance says, ask him what he has to do to win the golf tournament. Ask him what he has to do on the weekend to win the golf tournament. And I had asked him a question, a standard golf question at that point. And the second question I asked, remember, this is 2004. I said, Tiger, yeah. We all know you're getting married soon. How's that going to affect your fishing? And he laughed. And then he literally spent 90 seconds talking about how he and Elon had discovered spear fishing down in the islands and how, you know, when there's blood in the water, somebody has to be watching for sharks. And he got really into it. And at the end of it, I was like, Tiger, thank you. I sent it back to Bill McAtee and John Cook in the booth. John Cook, who I still work with on the Champions Tour these days.
Right.
And Cookie says, that's the best answer Tiger's ever given to one of the worst questions I've ever heard. Somebody needs to hire John McGuinness immediately. And although I did get the insurance license, I never sold a single policy. And I've been doing this ever since.
So that wrist injury, that surgery, as it turned out, John McGuinness, was the luckiest break you could have ever had.
Do you know how rich I'd be if I'd started selling insurance 20 years ago?
That's true as well.
If I could have sold it in the locker room to, you know, think of the guys I could have sold it to who had young families, like Jerry Kelly and Ernie Els and Retief Goosen. I could have sold them policies. And what
That's
did I
true.
Do? I decided to become a ne'er-do-well broadcaster.
But they kept you on, obviously. Was it right away? Was it Lance, the famous producer for CBS Sports? Or who was it who said, man, we got to keep you going. We're gonna sign you to whatever.
So Kevin Landy, who is, of course, head of communications now for the USGA, was the producer who hired me at USA Network. But it was Lance Barrow, when I finished with the Tiger interview, said, McGuinness, you're done. And I thought he was mad at me. And I went to thank everybody because that was literally my last week. And I waited for him to come out of the truck, and I shook his hand and said thank you. And then and he was great. And Lance and I are dear, dear friends now. I waited 15 or 20 more minutes for Kevin. So I didn't know if I was allowed to go in the truck. You know, that truck, that's sacred territory. And he came out and he said, do you know what I've been doing? And so what he said, I've been sending that interview all over the place. Everybody wanted a copy of it. I said, that's good, right? He said, That's good enough that I have a question for you. And I said, what he said, there's 11 weeks left in the season. What are you doing for him? I said, okay. Yeah. And that was how that happened. And of course, 2 years later, the Golf Channel took over Thursday, Friday coverage. As it turned out, at the exact same time, SiriusXM decided to start broadcasting golf.
Time is everything, right? Right, John?
Yeah. It just worked out. And then, you know, 7 years later, I started a show, and it's been a great run. It really has been.
Yeah, you've had a lot of fun, obviously. And you played with Tiger. I believe it was his third PGA Tour event, BC Open, up at Endicott. Was it? I mean, I would imagine it was apparent from his skills right away that he was above and beyond everybody. Was it? And also, did you interact with a very young Tiger Woods back then? What was that like, John?
So it's funny. On the Gravy and the Sleeves podcast, I told a story about playing with Tiger that day that apparently James Patterson, who has sold more books in the last 20 years than anybody on the planet, wrote a Tiger book, used my story that I told on Colton Drew's show verbatim, and never even bothered to never even bothered to call me. And my phone was out there, James. You could have called me. I would have helped you out. But I did play with Tiger, and we didn't know what to expect. The power was what really struck me, and the story that I told on that podcast was on the third hole, the first two holes at the old BC Open course, where they now play the Dick Sporting Goods Open on the Champions Tour, two short par fours. You don't hit driver. The third hole is par five. Tiger pulls it, hits a tree, kicks down in the fairway, but well back. I get it out there to the corner. I've got 240 to the front. That's about as far as I hit my three wood. So I'm in good shape for me. Tiger's 30 yards behind me. And he pulls out an iron. Remember, he had Fluff caddying for him at the time. And he pulls out iron because obviously from 270 to the front, this is a layup. He made a golf swing like one I'd never seen before. The golf club hitting the ball made a sound I had never heard before. And when the ball, back then, those balls were so soft that he could compress it so hard that the ball would take off and it would be on a piercing trajectory and then it would rise. And the really long hitters could get it to rise a second time, but not as much. This ball rose three times. When I thought it was about to start falling out of the air, it rose for the third time. It landed four steps on the front of the green and rolled to the back fringe. And I looked at Fluff, and I probably should have gotten penalized for this, but I said, what the F was that? Because Tiger was gone. He knew it when he hit it. And remember how skinny he was and how fast he was. He was 50 yards down the fairway by the time the ball landed. And Fluff looked at me, he said, that's our two iron. We carried about 275. I said, I'm averaging 268 off the tee this year, for goodness sake.
Two iron.
Yeah, two iron. And remember, just a tiny little butter knife of a Titleist blade with a Torbellata golf ball. Just sick.
What was he like back then in terms of interacting with him? Did you guys talk a lot?
We did. Tiger is a talker on the golf course, but I also think that, you know, this was Thursday, Friday, so it was very laid back. We both played well. I think he was 11 under and I was 8 under through two rounds. So there was that. Oh, and I never shut up, as you know. So, and Fluff and I had been friends for a couple of years at that point. I played in the U.S. Open the year before at Shinnecock and played a practice round with Peter Jacobson with Fluff on the bag. My mother went to school in Maine. We had a lot to talk about. And so it was very natural. I think that Tiger really knew immediately that I was not a threat. You know, his greatness was in front of him. This was my greatness, just being on the PGA Tour. This was I had reached my potential. And perhaps some would say exceeded my potential. You know, I don't know if he would have been nearly as engaging if I were Ernie Els or one of those other guys in that situation early on. But I felt like, and I've always had a good relationship with Tiger. A very healthy respect, obviously. But, I mean, I've always had friendly banter with him. And, you know, we've picked on each other. And I've enjoyed my time with him. I actually wish I'd spent more time with him.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Joined by John McGinnis here on Musings on Golf. So, John, I was talking to a guy recently who told me that when you introduced him to a very attractive world-class billiards player, that she referred to him, this gentleman who told me the story, and not you, as the main guy. right?
Yeah.
I believe you remember that. Do you recall that,
I
John?
do. I do. The Lawrences are lovely people, particularly Mitch. I'm not so sure about that woman that he married. The greatest billiards player of all time, the striking Viking, Ava
Right.
Mattia Lawrence, who called Katrick the main guy on our radio show, which somehow for that was probably 9 years ago, 10 years ago. It was at the World Am, and we've been doing the World Am in Myrtle Beach for I think this is our 10th year. So, yeah, she let that be known, and it was. I mean, it was the second time that I saw Brian Katrick take a knee laughing at my expense. The first time was, remember the writer Dermot Gillies?
Of course.
Dermot and Brian and I were walking away from the Masters before they built the new practice area when that was media parking. And I knew who he was, but he didn't know who we were. And we were having a lovely conversation walking out to the cars. And when we got there, Brian said, Mr. Gillies, I'm Brian Katrick, and I said, and I'm John McGinnis. He said, "Oh, funny that." I said, "What's that?" He said, "There used to be a young tour player by that name." I said, "Oh, did there?" He said, "Yeah, I used to follow him because it was the worst spelling of McGinnis I'd ever seen." I said, "How is it now?" He said, "And so I asked Casey Kerr. You remember Casey Kerr?" I said, "Sure, he's caddying for Vijay Singh this week." He said, "Right." He said, "I asked Casey Kerr, what can you tell me about that John McGinnis?" And I said, "I cannot wait to hear what Casey had to say." He said, "Casey said that boy couldn't play dead in an old Western. Most American expression I'd ever heard." I said, "Is that what he said?" Now Brian's on a knee. And Dermot says, "You don't know what happened to that young man that you share the name with." I said, "Well, I swallowed him about 10 years ago and I share the body with him as well." He said, "Oh." And now his eyebrows, which are all over the place, he's mortified. He said, "Oh, I hope that my anecdote amused you far more than it offended you." And I said, "No worries, Dermot. No worries. I'll be telling that story for the rest of my life."
That is awesome. That is hey, you explain that chemistry that you and Brian Katrick have. I mean, with Katrick and McGinnis on tap, it's been, when I talked to Brian the other day, he said, 12, 13 years you guys have been together on SiriusXM PGA Tour Radio. What is it? What's that chemistry?
So it started doing the play by play, when we were in the booth together, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I mean, we're putting golf on the radio. He had done the terrestrial version, which was very different. They didn't have people on the golf course. We had three people on the golf course, and he and I in the booth, and we're inventing it all as we're going. We didn't know what we were doing either, and we had a slew of producers along the way. Everybody had their own idea. We had a slew of owners along the way. Everybody had their own idea. I mean, to call it chaos is kindness. And so we had to figure out a rhythm that made sense for the two of us because we worked together, 25 times a year. And then shortly thereafter, the talk shows came about, and he had his show and I had my show. And I learned. Don't he's not going to hear this, right? Because he doesn't need to know how much I
Of
learned
course,
from
it would
him.
never happen.
Mostly everything I do, I stole from Brian Katrick, and I tried to make a little bit quicker and a little bit funnier. And we have fallen into the same roles on the show that we did in the play-by-play. I mean, he takes us in and out of commercial. I'm happy to. I don't need to. That's who he is. That's where he's the most comfortable, and I'm the most comfortable hitting the shots and taking the shots that he sets up or doesn't set up or doesn't see coming, which is my favorite part. We're very, very different. I don't know. We've never had in 20 years. We've never had a political conversation, not once.
There you go.
We talk about golf. We talk about our families. This is socially. And we talk about whether or not he's going to be up late enough to drive me home. Those are the things that we talk about because he doesn't drink. And I drink enough for both of us, or I used to before I started a second family. So we're similar in a lot of ways. We're very different in a lot of ways. I wouldn't be here without Brian. Brian would probably still be doing this without me. He made me fall in love with golf again. You'll talk to any number of players who are retired, who the game passed by, and they quit for any number of years because they're just frustrated with it. And it took me from 2005, probably to 2012, before I actually enjoyed playing golf again. And it was Brian who gets excited every single time he goes to the golf course. He plays golf more than anybody I know. He was largely responsible for getting me back into the fold and being a golfer again.
Well, that's fantastic. You mentioned about second fatherhood in a way, if you would. What's that been like later in life to sort of as you said, restart, John McGinnis? How has that been for you? Has it been a challenge, a thrill? What?
Let's put it this way, for the people who don't know. I have a 20, almost 27-year-old who graduated from Georgia Tech, lives in Denver. He's an endurance athlete and a cybersecurity expert. I have a 25-year-old who graduated from Duke and is going to grad school and becoming a marine biologist. And I have a 5-year-old who's on his way to kindergarten. Not too many people sending one to grad school and one to kindergarten this year. And the kindergartner has a 14-month-old younger brother. So when I say I started over, I started over. I mean, I love it. I did not see this one coming.
You
I mean,
still get to travel and do the things that you love to do. So you've got that balance, right?
as I explained to her, I'm unemployable in any other realm at this point. So this is pretty much what I have to do. And I love doing it. We've reached a nice balance where I try not to have very many stretches where I work 2 weeks in a row. So, like, I'm actually not working Caves Valley this week. I'm working the Champions Tour event in Calgary.
Very
And
good.
then
Okay.
and then I'm off next week for the Tour Championship. And then I don't remember what's next after that, and the Ryder Cup and a couple more Champions Tour events. But I try not to work 2 weeks in a row more than once or twice a year. There's a couple of times that it's inevitable. I live in North Carolina. I'm always going to want to do what's now the Truist at Quail Hollow, and that's the week before the PGA Championship. And I work the PGA Championship for ESPN. So those are 2 weeks that I'm going to work, two in a row. Other than that, I try not to do two in a row at all.
Great. That's terrific. Let's talk about what was a crazy Sunday in Memphis, John. I saw you posting on X yesterday. While you may not know the process involved, you feel that Justin Rose of England absolutely, positively should be knighted, right?
Absolutely.
Why do you feel so strongly?
I don't know. I don't even know what it, because Andy Murray got knighted at 30 because he won Wimbledon. I mean,
Yes.
granted, I understand. An Englishman hadn't won Wimbledon in 1,000 years, but Justin Rose won an Olympic gold medal. He's a U.S. Open champion. He's headed to the Hall of Fame. Knight this guy. I think they've given him some sort of order. So he does have a title. Why would you knight him?
Are
Gotta
he
knight him.
and I asked you before we came on about Tommy Fleetwood, and I want to expand on that a second in terms of Tommy's personality. Tommy and Justin, at least to the public, seem like just rock solid human beings. Is that perception with the people we see, is that who they are?
Yeah, I'm fortunate enough that the end of my career and the beginning of Justin's career overlapped, and I got to play with Justin and got to know him as a young gentleman, and now I see him as an older gentleman, and I use the word gentleman twice in that sentence on purpose, because he is a true professional. He's a true gentleman. His generation, and there aren't many of them left. But at the Wyndham Championship, I did a Q&A for the Pro-Am dinner with Adam Scott, and I put them right in the same category of just solid guys who aren't the least bit concerned about doing anything at this point in their lives, but playing the best golf they can play and putting their best foot forward. And they are gracious with their time and their energy. And I couldn't have been happier for Justin Rose. I feel terrible for Tommy Fleetwood. And I feel like Tommy Fleetwood's going to have his David Duvall moment where he finally gets it done and gets it done a lot. I think he's going to have to beat Cameron Young, who got it done the week before. Or maybe Tommy ends up like Colin Montgomery. Who knows?
It's just stunning, John. This will be his 163rd PGA Tour event this week for Fleetwood without a win. I mean, it's almost inconceivable, right?
It is. He has as much talent and ability as anybody in the game. But translating that into victories, there are some players who have that niche, that ability to get it over the finish line, and there are some that don't. And there's no knowing which one of those a player is until he's in that situation. It seemed like Tiger won every time he had a chance. But then there's even other players who didn't have that many chances, but then won a lot. Like Rocco Mediate back from my era.
Right.
You know, there's only one tournament that Rocco probably should have won that he didn't. And that guy I mentioned before him did it. And that was the 2008 U.S. Open, of course, where Tiger and Rocco were in the playoff.
Right.
This is an anomaly. This is why sports psychologists get rich, because these are questions that nobody can answer, but they do make up good answers for them. And then one of them is going to take a lot of credit when Tommy Fleetwood finally does win his first golf tournament. I think for Tommy, he's going to have to either do it like Cam Young did it, which is get out to a big enough lead that you can't lose, or shoot 62 on Sunday and come from behind and run somebody down from six shots.
Winning is hard. You and I are doing this interview. It's about 4:25 on Tuesday afternoon, August the 12th. Earlier today, I interviewed Mike Small, the longtime golf coach at the University of Illinois, and he was teammates with Steve Stricker back when they played for the Illini. And he talked about Stricker. He could see even back when Strick was in college that he knew how to win, right? And there's, John, that's a massive difference, isn't it? Knowing how, I mean, you won three times on what's now Korn Ferry, but that winning psychologically has to be night and day for a tour player as opposed to not being able to get over that hump.
Well, I've known Mike forever. Going back to the 90s when he was a player. And boy, talk about a guy who made the right career choice. I mean, he could still play, but he is a great coach. Illinois had put one player on tour before he got there, and his name was Steve Stricker. And now, you know, there's a half a dozen of them. I covered some Champions Tour events. I covered Steve Stricker last year at South Dakota.
Yeah.
In the Champions Tour event, which I don't know what number win that was for him on the Champions Tour, somewhere in the 20s probably. He had no business winning that golf tournament. He didn't play well enough on Saturday or Sunday to win, but he shot a low enough score to get himself in the playoff. And then he gritted out a couple of holes in the playoff and won. And it seemed almost preordained because he didn't have any, like I said, he didn't have any business winning the golf tournament. We've seen that from Scotty a little bit over the last couple of years, you know, where he just gets it done. You don't see too many players win without playing their best. You know, JJ Spahn played his best golf this past week, and it wasn't quite good enough to beat Justin Rose. It was great golf. It was fun to watch. The playoff was fun. He played his best golf on the back nine at the U.S. Open, and it was enough. But that's it. I mean, we've seen what he's capable of, and he's not scared of the moment. But there's that extra thing that some players have, and like Justin Thomas has it. He doesn't give himself that many chances, but boy, what's he got? 17 wins now on the PGA Tour? That's mind-boggling. Jordan Spieth, let's hope he gets himself into position to get it again. Right now, he's just not giving himself the chances.
What's going on with him, by the way, in your opinion, with Jordan?
You know, the injury, I think, took a bigger toll. Surgery, third child coming. There's a lot going on in Jordan Spieth's life.
Hey, I want to ask you about your life growing up, John. You were up in a golf family in Durham, North Carolina, right? Did everybody play?
No, well, I'm the youngest of four, the last child, who if you have four kids, you know, that last one's equal parts spoiled and neglected. And that was great because I was raised at the golf course. We lived not very far from what's not a great golf course by any stretch, but it was our golf course. And
what's it called?
Well, back then it was Willow Haven Country Club. We gave it another name. Now it's something else now. But anyway, Fran James is the pro there. She does a fabulous job. At any rate, I fell in love with it early on. I think I was probably 11. My brother was 13, maybe we're 10 and 12. When my father said, this summer, you can either play junior tournaments or you can play Little League Baseball, but you can't do both. You can't be good at both at the same time. So you have to pick one or the other. And my brother picked golf. And at that point, I said, okay, I'll pick golf too. And I thought that meant you go to the driving range every day and try to get as good as you can. Nobody told me any different. And I was so obnoxious that the pro was more than happy to have me on the driving range instead of bothering him in his pro shop. And I hit balls and hit balls. And by the time I was 14, 13 or 14, he had played the tour back in the 60s and 70s. And he said, you have to hit 1,000 balls a day. Well, it takes about 5.5 hours to hit 1,000 balls. Anybody doing that today is going to end up in traction, and certainly having surgery on certain joints. Anyway, so that's what we did. And I walked onto the team at East Carolina. I wasn't all that great. And then I qualified for a U.S. amateur my second year, and I qualified for the next two after that. And it just evolved into what I thought that it could be. And that was, I thought that I could be good enough to at least give it a shot. It turned out I was really good at qualifying for things. I mean, qualifying for things really matters in this game. At least it used to. It may not matter going forward as much as it used to, but being able to get through Q school or being able to get through a Monday or US Open qualifier, those things mattered.
I lived across the street a number of years ago from Ryan Howison, who you defeated in a playoff for your second win on what was then the Hogan Tour. That was Dakota Dunes, I believe.
He and Sean Murphy were the other two in the playoff.
Well, right. And Howison is a fascinating story because he played collegiate baseball at North Carolina. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then
left field.
Took up golf. What was it like to win for the first time on what was then the Hogan Tour? And that, I guess in a lot of ways, that was sort of your mental springboard to feel like you had a shot to play on the PGA Tour.
So this is a crazy story. The Nike Tour Championship, it was Nike then.
It was
in Oregon in 1994. Hmm. And it was on ESPN, believe it or not. Andy North was there. And I had played myself into the last group. David Duvall was in front of me, for goodness sake. And the fog rolled in, as it's prone to do in the fall in Oregon. And about 30 minutes before the fog rolls out, they said to get it in on ESPN, we're going to send the last group out first. So I didn't get the benefit of being in the final group. I went out first. And I get to 18, thinking I need a birdie. I've got 4 iron over water. I hit a really good shot that came up about 2 steps short, hit the bulkhead, back in the water, lose the tournament. Par would have gotten me into a playoff. Didn't know it at the time because I didn't have the luxury. Anyway, it is what it is. I stewed all winter long. And the win was the first tournament of the year the next year in San Jose, California. Yeah. And I don't remember how many I won by, but I wasn't going to lose that one. Winning, you have to believe that you deserve it somehow. And I don't care what level that is. I don't care what level that is. I don't care if it's the club championship, if it's the junior club championship, whatever it is, you don't back into winning. You have to believe that it's your turn, that you deserve this, that it's yours, and people have to take it away from you. They can't. And I never got there mentally on the PGA Tour,
mostly because I was a realist and understood what my talent level was, which is a shame because I know a lot of guys who had lesser talent but believed more. I think that's the thing. I think at some point, Tommy is going to do what Cam Young did last week and just get angry enough to go out there and take his.
Just a few more questions for John McGinnis here. John, appreciate your time so much here on Musings on Golf. We base this show on storytelling, and you're the perfect guest for it. Could you please tell the story about when you played with Nick Faldo and you tried to get him? I think it was at Valspar, and you were just trying to get him to talk. You're the chirper, and he didn't want to say anything, right?
He didn't. I don't think I could tell the whole story,
right?
But I could tell this much of it. He had Fanny on the bag. It was a twosome. It was a Saturday. I was used to the 9:30 Saturday morning tee time. For him, that was very, very early. Sure. And I had my good buddy Barry Williams on the bag, who won with Boo Weekly at Colonial, won with John Rollins, a great caddy. Somebody should hire him now because he's such a good greens reader, and that's a bigger and bigger part of caddying once again. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to get that guy to talk today. He said, oh my God, you're going to embarrass me, aren't you? I said, probably. And what I didn't realize, because I hadn't played with Nick, is that I wasn't very long. He wasn't very long either. We drove it right next to each other on the first hole. That's bad news for him. That means that we're going to talk all the way to the ball. He doesn't get to keep going when we get to mine. And so we chatted and I chatted. He never said a word. Number one, he didn't say a word. I talked the whole hole. Fanny can now see what's happening. And I love Fanny. And she's now thinks it's kind of funny. And I talked to him up the second hole. Nothing. We hit our tee shots up three. It's the little par four where you lay up and then hit basically the same shot to the green. And I said, hey, Nick. And he doesn't even look. He doesn't even grunt at this point. I said, did you ever come here and play in that old J.C. Penney? Well, now I've asked him a direct question. I'm not just talking to him. I've asked him a direct question. No. I said, you know, where the LPGA Tour and the PGA Tour players played together. And he looks over. I am going to tell it. He looks over and he says, only words he said to me all the entire front nine. Sounds dangerous. And that's it. That's all he said.
Dangerous.
And that was it. I mean, I declared victory right there and left him alone for a few holes. And then, of course, he got into this side of the business. And we found out.
What a makeover that was, John, for him.
We found out that there was a whole different person there. You know, and that was really cool to see. I think that he became the broadcaster he became because of the guy that he sat next to. I think Jim Nantz can get the best out of anybody that sits down next to him. And I think he invented Tony Romo, and he certainly has done an incredible job with Trevor Immelman. But not that those guys wouldn't have been good on their own. They're great because of Jim Nantz.
John, two more questions. One golf-related, and then one kind of a personal one to wrap up the show. A lot of implications for Ryder Cup teams over the next couple weeks. The top 6 points for the U.S. team is determined after the BMW Championship, and then Captain Bradley will choose, I believe, after the Tour Championship to round out. I'm not sure exactly the European, but what's your sense right now? Obviously, playing on Long Island before a very rabid, crazed American crowd, that seems to me, John, the real plus. What's your sense of how these two teams will look going in there, at least on paper?
Well, I think that the European team is set. I don't think it matters what happens this week or next week. I think unless somebody does something crazy like an Aaron Rye victory, or I don't even know if he's in the field this week, to be honest with you, but somebody from outside moves in. I think that the first 11 names you see on their list right now are on that team, and John Rahm is the 12th. John Rahm's not on that list. I think that's it. I think Luke Donald's job is the easiest one he's ever had in terms of putting his squad together. By contrast, I don't think that it's ever been more difficult for the American captain. Not only because he's part of the conversation, which he shouldn't be a part of the conversation, but he's going to have seven guys at the end of this week. I say seven, six automatic. He's told the world Bryson DeChambeau's on that team.
That's right.
So now he's got five picks. One of them has to be himself. And he's gonna is he gonna leave off, Colin Morikawa or Patrick Cantlay or and go with some of this fresh blood like Ben Griffin, Andrew Novak, Chris Goddard. We got guys that they don't even have their sizes in front of the Ryder Cup committee yet. And I mean, they have legitimate shots of making this team. I think that's very exciting and is going to be no captain's going to ever be second guessed more than Keegan Bradley if he doesn't win this Ryder Cup. He's going to be beaten up like Hal Sutton was 20 years ago.
Why do you feel he should pick himself?
Because he belongs on the team. He's a great asset. He's a fierce competitor. He's an emotional leader. And he's playing great golf. I mean, he's playing well enough. Which the bottom line is how you playing? Well, he's playing well enough to be on this team. And he's managed to do that in the most hectic year of his entire professional career. Imagine if we take that part away and just say, go play in New York, Keegan.
Checks all the boxes, John. And I would imagine, to your point about Cantlay, he wants desperately for Cantlay and Colin Morikawa to play well in these next
Yes.
2 weeks, right?
Of course he does. Of course he does. Because those guys got their asses kicked in Italy and they can't be happy about that. But they also were a part of the largest victory in the history of the Ryder Cup 4 years ago in the US. They know what that feels like. And experience matters. Experience matters, and there's only one way to get it. You can't fake experience.
Hey, John, final question. You've been so good to be with us. And this is a question I ask at the every end of every one of our podcasts. If you could have John McGuinness, a dream foursome, if you could have three other people, and they could be family members, it could be a Mr. Palmer type, whether they're living or deceased, who would round out your dream foursome and where would you play?
So when I was young, 8 or 9 years old, 7, 8, 9 years old, and my brother was a couple of years older. My father had a job where he flew in on Friday nights and then flew out on Monday mornings. And so he worked it out with our pro that we went out first and that we would never hold anybody up. And so at 7 o'clock, we were out there carrying our clubs and walking in the dew. And it would be the three of us, and quite frankly, no one else is invited.
It'd be you, your
My
dad,
brother.
your brother.
Yeah, and my brother and my father and I.
Just the three of you.
My father died in 1987, my freshman year of college. So he never got to see my college career. He never got to see my professional career. And he never got to see that I lived up to the Irish part of our heritage and became as full of crap as he was.
But John, he made that time that you had with him, that memory never leaves you, does it?
No, that was great. It was how we spent our childhood. And every now and then he'd invite somebody to come in and play with us. Good player, Lex Alexander, who won a national championship at Wake Forest, played with us sometimes. There were people that were invited, but it was a standing deal. This is what we were doing on Saturday morning. There was no other option, and it was great. It was really cool that he arranged for that to be the way that it was.
Where would you play? Would you go back to your old
Of
haunts and play
course,
there?
the little old golf course. When my brother turned 50, I made him go to Pebble Beach. He was never going to play it, so we took a group to Pebble Beach. And when I turned 50, we took a group to the old course, and I made him go on that trip. So he's gotten to see some things, but it'd be the little dump, Willow Haven over there in Durham, North Carolina. one last time.
That's fabulous. John McGuinness, this has been a real treat. Enjoy the PGA Tour Champions event this week. And you've got a busy time coming up. I know you're going to be able to see your family some, but you've got the Tour Championship and then the really what's the pinnacle of the year, John, with the Ryder Cup, right? It's an event unlike any other.
Well, yeah, it's going to be great. We're going to do it on radio. Those New Yorkers, because they didn't have enough to be fired up, will have earbuds. They'll be able to hear the broadcast on the property. So they'll be cheering at 17 for something that gets called on 15. It's just mayhem. It's my favorite 3 days in golf, period.
No question about it. John McGuinness, thanks so much for being here on Musings on Golf. At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deer skin, calf skin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. So many takeaways from what John McGuinness had to say. First of all, thank you to John for taking the time out. We interviewed him earlier today, just before he went on with Brian for their show. And I agree with John's point that I had mentioned before we went to the interview, and was echoed by Patrick Cantlay and Ricky Fowler, that it's time for Keegan. It's his time to play, to be that playing captain. And I think the U.S. needs him. I agree wholeheartedly with John's view that, you look at the 12-man team that the Europeans are going to have at Bethpage Black for the Ryder Cup next month, and it's almost a carbon copy in a lot of ways of what they had 2 years ago when they frankly demolished the U.S. Outside of Rome. So Keegan, I anticipate him picking himself, whether he's in that or whether he earns it in the top six after this week, or picking himself then to be on that Ryder Cup team. Two other guys who will be playing in the Ryder Cup as well are Tommy Fleetwood and Justin Rose. And John McGuinness's take on Fleetwood was fascinating in regards to maybe, as he said, putting the coins in a different pocket or his tees in a different pocket just to do something differently. I keep going back, folks, to Rory McIlroy going about it a different way when he won the Masters and sort of just staying in his little shell. I don't know. Maybe there's some way that Fleetwood notches that first victory. This will be his 163rd try in a PGA Tour event to win. And maybe he has to do something differently psychologically. The margin of error was so small last week. He the par 5 16th, a very easy hole for those guys. He had to scramble just to make par, and then he made a bad bogey at 17, and the freight train of Justin Rose and also JJ Spahn down the stretch making all the putts, and it left Fleetwood out outside of the winner's circle once again. For Justin Rose, wow, 45, deeply committed to his game. He will be a major force at the Ryder Cup next month. He'll be a future captain of that team, by the way. Let's hear what Justin Rose had to say about what winning in Memphis meant to him.
Oh, wow. I'll tell you what, it feels amazing to get it done. I mean, today was obviously a great opportunity starting the day. There were a lot of, I guess for me, storylines involved, playing with Tommy, one of my best friends out here on tour, clearly, Scotty right there, a whole chasing pack. But, starting the day one back, clearly, that's an awesome opportunity to have a chance of winning a tournament. But kind of wasn't going my way. Front line was slow for both me and Tommy. So, I feel like there were loads of guys, well, there were four of us in the mix heading into the back nine. And I stalled a little bit. But then you know, the last five holes, I played some of my best golf, and I kind of felt like I pulled it together when I really had to. And then even in the playoff, I continued to hit great shots. And that just makes it, I guess, so much fun as a competitor to really, 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 when you have to hit the shots to find them. And, you know, I take a lot of pride in that today. It kind of puts me right back in, you know, the season's race. I haven't even looked at where they'd project me and all these types of things. They're back up in the, you know, in the realms of where I sat for a long time. You know, I haven't been back to East Lake since 2019, and that's been bugging me. And that's obviously been a huge goal. So obviously that's taken care of. And, you know, I definitely played some good golf this year when it mattered. Like I feel like my good has been good. My consistency hasn't been there, though I've been telling people that I feel like when I play my best golf, I'm able to compete with the best players in the world. And obviously today proven that I can win against the best players in the world. So it's a gratifying day for me.
That should be gratifying for him. Don't forget, Justin Rose pushed. I got a little bit of luck, of course, at the Masters, and Rory botching the 18th hole on Sunday and making bogey. But he pushed him and lost in the playoff, had that chance for birdie on that first hole of the playoff. It's just a number for him, in my opinion. He's 45, but as you heard, and he wants to get back to the tour championship. And I guarantee you, he will be super laser focused when it comes to the Ryder Cup next month. As a matter of fact, yeah, I think that a team concept for Fleetwood, and with having, frankly, some grizzled veteran guys like Justin Rose, having his back, I think will serve Fleetwood again extremely well when it comes to the team competition at the Ryder Cup next month. Again, thank you so much to John McGinnis for joining us. It was great. Really, really a lot of fun with him. Don't forget as well, folks, the U.S. Amateur is being played this week out at the Olympic Club outside of San Francisco. What a fabulous golf course that is. Excited to see how everything plays out. Thanks to John McGinnis. Next week, Rich Lerner from Golf Channel will be joining us as we wrap up the BMW Championship and look ahead to the Tour Championship and the Ryder Cup. Kelly Elbin signing off, along with our fabulous executive producer, Jenna Self. Thanks for joining us once again on Musings on Golf.